This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven. Easy if you try. Sky. Imagine all the people living for today.
Greetings, all you evolved humans, godless infidels, and happy heretics. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. This is Free Thought Radio with irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
And I'm Dan Barker, your friendly neighborhood atheist. A man and his son were at the beach, and the little boy came running up and said, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy, come look what I found." He took him over, and there was a dead seagull on the sand. And the little boy said, "What happened, Daddy? What happened?" And the man said, "Oh, well, that seagull died and went to heaven." And the little boy looked down and said, "Well, then, did God throw him back?" The show is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, based in Madison, Wisconsin, the largest organization of freethinkers, atheists, and agnostics, skeptics, whatever we call ourselves, working to keep state and church separate. And we hope someday you will join us. If you want to join, become a member of the largest association of nonbelievers in the country, you can go to ffrf.org and sign up.
Charles Darwin's birthday is coming up next Tuesday. That's February 12th. And he was born on the same day and in the same year, 1809, as Abraham Lincoln. Both of these great men were unorthodox in their religious beliefs, but of course, Darwin became a complete believer. And we're delighted to have with us for our show today, in honor of Darwin, Matthew Chapman, the great-great-grandson of Charles Darwin.
Matthew Chapman is a film director, he's a screenwriter, and he wrote the highly entertaining book, 40 Days and 40 Nights, which covered the 2005 trial over the so-called intelligent design in Dover, Pennsylvania public schools. The trial, by the way, which the creationists lost.
Now, polls keep showing that Americans are the most likely to be creationists in the Western world and Japan, when you look at the Western world and Japan. Only adults in Turkey express more doubts about evolution, and this is largely due to the widespread fundamentalism here and the politicization. Thank you. Of science in the United States.
More Americans actually believe in the devil than in Darwin, according to a Harris poll that was released late last year. That poll showed that 79% of Americans believe in miracles. 75% believe in heaven. 72% believe Jesus is God or the Son of God. 62% believe in hell and in the devil. But only 42% of us Americans, and I don't know if we use the word believe, but put the word belief in quotes, 42% of us Americans believe in Darwin's theory of natural selection.
Accept that theory.
Through evolution.
And we see other polls that show about 50%. I've seen some polls that show slightly more than 50% of Americans do accept evolution. But you can see, I mean, that's a vast pool of ignorance. There was only one good thing about that last Harris poll. It did find that 18% of Americans don't believe in a God, and that's higher than the typical finding of 14 to 16%. So there might be a lot of fundamentalists out there, but seculars are gaining in the United States.
Well, we are evolving is what's happening.
And before we talk with the great-great-grandson of Charles Darwin, who's an author and filmmaker living in the United States, let's talk a little bit more about Charles Darwin. Dan and I may be atheists, but we actually made a pilgrimage. Do you remember, Dan?
Yeah, to England.
We went to Down House, which is in the British village of Down. That's spelled with an E at the end. And that's Darwin's home. And it was recently restored by the English Heritage. And we did this on a trip several years ago when we were staying in London. And you remember what a jaunt it was.
Yeah, taking the train and then you get on a bus. And
we
then
took the tube and we transferred at Victoria Station.
Yeah.
Then we took a train.
And then you take a bus. And then the bus.
It was a 16-mile train trip.
And the bus drops you off in front of this tavern out in the country. And then you have to walk through the kind of by these sheep fields or out into the country to this house.
And so we walked a quarter mile to the outskirts of this pretty village of Down, and there was, in the country, Down's house, and very beautifully restored.
Well, and after reading all these biographies of Charles Darwin, to actually be there, it was an almost religious experience for us non-religious people.
And I think first things first, though, we went to the tea room. It was very cold when we went there. And Dan, you remember, we took some self-guided tours.
They have these earphones that you can just go through the entire house and see Darwin's study. You can see where he worked. You can see the room where the children played. And then outside is very interesting with the walk that was there. What was it called? The sand walk?
And Contemplation Trail.
And Contemplation Trail.
But inside, I thought it was very interesting to see Emma, the rather religious wife of Darwin, regularly read novels out loud to her family. She gave birth to 10 children, and 8 of them survived. So her collection of books was there, Dickens, Thackeray, Austen. And then there was, in Darwin's study, the water closet, which was an innovation, and a bath that was installed for his comfort, because Darwin was a semi-invalid during part of his life. He probably had contracted...
Nobody knows.
Yeah, we don't know what it was.
He picked up something
or
on
something
his trip.
Else.
But he had stomach problems and nausea.
The Galapagos or something. And then we also learned what an indulgent father he was. He would let his children run riot among his very valuable collections. He was always studying things. And he had barnacles that he studied, and they were very famous, and you could see some of them out there. And in this audiophone self-tour that we took, they had a very cute anecdote about one of his sons. His son had asked one of his playmates, imagining that all fathers were like his father, he asked the neighbor boy, "Where does your father do his barnacles?" And there was a microscope chair that they were allowed to twirl around in, and we learned about what a nice person Darwin was. He was very nice to his children, very nice to his servants. He enlarged their quarters and decorated it. He hung out with one of the servants, a manservant. They would play billiards together when he needed recreation.
Upstairs, there's a museum exhibit upstairs. One is devoted to documenting the outcry, mostly the religious outcry, which greeted the publication of Charles Darwin's book On the Origin of Species in 1859. And this book was followed up by the even more controversial The Descent of Man in 1871. Darwin wrote in that book, "For my part, I would as soon be descended from a baboon as from a savage who delights to torture his enemies, treats his wives like slaves, and is haunted by the grossest superstitions."
Darwin described himself as an agnostic in his memoirs. They were published after his death, I think 1887. He died in 1882. So, of course, his family edited it, and they decided to expunge all his views on religion.
His wife was quite a believer,
very distressed about his lack of belief. But in 1958, his granddaughter, Nora Barlow, made sure that his original autobiography, with the original omissions, was restored and published. And, Dan, why don't you read this famous passage from the autobiography?
He didn't write it for publication. He just wrote it for the family, but then they decided to publish it later. But here's what they put back in. Darwin said, "I can indeed hardly see how anyone ought to wish Christianity to be true. For if so, the plain language of the text seems to show that the men who do not believe, and this would include my father, brother, and almost all my best friends, will be everlastingly punished. And this is a damnable doctrine."
And Dan, you've been reading a current bio on Darwin. Which one is that, and what stands out to you?
David Quammen's book I just read, a nice little a brief bio called The Reluctant Mr. Darwin. And I was impressed with how gradual Darwin's deconversion was. He was a devout believer at the beginning, a strong believer.
They wanted him to be a clergyman, didn't they?
Yeah, and he was a believer. He believed in, you know, the Creator and all that, but very gradually. And he even said himself that he couldn't think of a single point along the way, almost comparing it to the evolution of species over vast periods of time. In his own life, there was an evolution of ideas in his mind. And when he got to the end of it, he couldn't remember when and where it happened, but he knew that he was an agnostic, a non-believer. And he says his views are now as firm as they'll ever be, and he could not see how they could ever be changed back to belief.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor with Dan Barker for Free Thought Radio. In a few minutes, we'll be celebrating Darwin's upcoming birthday, February 12th, by talking with his great-great-grandson, Matthew Chapman.
Give me that old-time religion. Give me that old-time religion. Give me that old-time religion. And that's good enough for me.
Ask for a sample issue of Free Thought today and find out more about the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org or phone 1-800-335-4021. This is Free Thought Radio on Air America. Margaret Sanger's motto was, "No gods, no masters." This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Geller with Dan Barker for Free Thought Radio. We're commemorating the birth of one of science's greatest minds, Charles Darwin. His February 12th birthday is celebrated globally now by Free Thought Association students, scientists, and we'll be talking in a few minutes with Charles Darwin's great-great-grandson, Matthew Chapman. On a related topic, Free Thought Radio got a question from a listener, so let's go to our Ask an Atheist segment.
This is Ask an Atheist, where Free Thought Radio takes your calls and questions.
People often say to me, something that can't come from nothing. Somebody must have created it. How do I respond to that?
There are a number of ways to respond to that question. First of all, ask yourself, how many ways are there for nothing to exist? Just one. But how many ways are there for something to exist? There's an awful lot of ways for something to exist. So which is more likely, something or nothing? Or a second way to respond is to ask, why do we assume that nothing is the default state of the universe? Why does nothingness trump somethingness? Why do we think that nature, if left unperturbed, would revert to nothing? Which is more powerful, something or nothing? Or a third way to respond is to ask, if it is true that nothing comes from nothing, then is God, if he exists, not nothing? If nothing comes from nothing, then God, by that very argument, had to come from something. So we're just answering one mystery with another mystery and not answering anything at all. Another way to answer the question is to say that the very word nothing implies something, no thing. If you don't have any dirt in the hole, you have nothing in the hole. So without something, the concept of nothing is meaningless. So it's really a stupid question to ask. Five, scientists, in fact, have shown that something can come from nothing. In the complete vacuum of outer space, where there's no matter at all, virtual particles and antiparticles are being created and destroyed all the time due to quantum fluctuations. And once in a while, two of those particles get separated from their partner, like at the edge of a black hole, and voila, something comes from nothing. But I suppose a cute way to ask this question is to say, if you don't really think something can come from nothing, well, how do you explain the popularity of Britney Spears?
If you have a question or comment for Ask an Atheist, call our talkback number, 608-204-0422, 608-204-0422.
We've interviewed on a previous show one of America's foremost Darwin aficionados and scholars, the poet Philip Appleman. He's also the editor of the Norton Critical Edition of Darwin, which you can order from ffrf.org, by the way, or you can find it at your favorite bookstore.
Philip Appleman recently penned a poem on intelligent design to be sung to the tune of a hymn I think you'll recognize, and he asked my co-host, Dan Barker, who's a piano player and arranger, to record it. So in honor of Charles Darwin's birthday, let's listen to Intelligent Design.
Your eyes have seen a blurry scene that's only known to man. Your optic nerves are backward and have been since time began. That's what the preachers tell you is God's very special plan. Intelligent design. Glory, glory, hallelujah. The great designer knows what's due ya. Nothing else can stick it to ya like intelligent design. You wish a guy's...
That was Dan singing part of Philip Appleman's Intelligent Design song.
I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor for Free Thought Radio. Don't miss part two. We'll be speaking with Matthew Chapman, the great-great-grandson of Charles Darwin, an iconoclast in his own right. Let's listen to a little bit of the movie, Inherit the Wind. This is Frederick March and Spencer Tracy as Clarence Darrow.
I object, I object, I object.
On what grounds? Is it possible that something is holy to the celebrated agnostic?
Yes, the individual human mind, in a child's power to master the multiplication table, there is more sanctity than in all your shouted amens and holy holies and hosannas. An idea is a greater monument than a cathedral, and the advance of man's knowledge is a greater miracle than all the sticks turned to snakes or the parting of the waters. Darwin took us forward to a hilltop, from where we could look back and see the way from which we came. But for this insight and for this knowledge, we must abandon our faith in the pleasant poetry of Genesis.
We must not abandon faith!
Well, that was a very dramatic segment from Inherit the Wind about the Scopes Trial. We'll be talking about the Scopes Trial and Intelligent Design with Matthew Chapman.
He wrote a book about that trial, too, so we'll talk about that.
Find out more about Free Thought Radio and the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. or phone 1-800-335-4021. This is Free Thought Radio. Protect the First Amendment. It protects you. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Dan Barker here with Annie Laurie Gaylor for Free Thought Radio. And we have on the phone with us Matthew Chapman. He's the great-great-grandson of Charles Darwin, whose February 12th birthday we are commemorating in this week's show. Matthew Chapman is the author of Trials of the Monkey, an Accidental Memoir, and a new book about the recent trial in Dover, Pennsylvania, on the intelligent design controversy. The book is called 40 Days and 40 Nights. Matthew Chapman is a film director, a screenwriter whose writing credits include Consenting Adults and Runaway Jury. He was born in England. He moved to America, where he lives now. He's currently preparing to direct his script, The Ledge, which is what he calls a philosophical thriller. Welcome to Free Thought Radio, Matthew Chapman.
Well, thank you for having me.
I really enjoyed your book. I've done a lot of reading on that Dover trial. The decision came down in the end of 2005, but yours, I have to say, was the funnest up-close personal book, and you went in person and sat there and interviewed people. What made you want to write a book like this?
Well, I am... my first book was about the Scopes trial and a journey I took to the town where it took place in 1925. And I love that trial. I think it's a fantastic part of American history. And frankly, I didn't think that there could be another trial like that. And then I started reading what was going on down in Dover, Pennsylvania. And one of the things about the Scopes trial was that all of the scientific evidence was thrown out of court, and so didn't really enter into the debate. Whereas in the Dover case, science was really at the center of it.
They finally got their day in court.
And you know, scientists supporting the theory of evolution came out in force to talk about it. And it just seemed like it would be a very interesting occasion and a kind of an education, really.
So why is the book called 40 Days and 40 Nights?
Well, it spanned 40 days and 40 nights.
The trial did.
The trial did, yeah. And of course, there's the whole business about the flood and all of that stuff. But at the very end of the trial, the plaintiff for the Dover School Board, who were the people pushing to have intelligent design included in science class, stood up and said to the judge, I see that you may notice that this is the 40th day of the trial. It's lasted 40 days and 40 nights, and I wonder if that was intentional. And the judge said, no, it's an interesting coincidence, but it was not by design. And, I met a lot of very interesting people down there who I got to like very much.
You met Tammy Kitzmiller, who was the lead plaintiff?
I did, and she was a terrific woman. But I got to know people from all sides. I got to know the people who had, I think religious reasons for wanting intelligent design included in class. I got to know Democrats. I got to know Republicans. One of the interesting things about it was that the plaintiffs, the 11 parents suing the school board to have intelligent design removed from science class, they were believers. I mean, I think there was probably one person who had their doubts, but most of them went to one sort of a church or another. And they were Democrats, they were Republicans, they were independents. It was a case about the First Amendment and the Establishment Clause.
And teaching religion in our public schools, which is what intelligent design really is. It's a thinly veiled religious doctrine being pushed in the science classroom.
Well, that's certainly what the judge concluded, who is a believer and a Republican, and a very good friend of mine, a man who I deeply admire and very much like.
I enjoyed that part of the book where you were in his living room talking with him just as a person.
Well, he's such a thoughtful man. I mean, I think one of the things I found, I always find when I leave the big cities, I've lived in Los Angeles and I've lived in New York, and I find that when you go out of the big cities and actually sort of get out to what America is really all about, is you find that your preconceptions of what a believer is, say, or your preconceptions of what a Democrat is or a Republican, they actually defy the cliches that sort of build up when you live in a big city. And I met some really thoughtful people, on both sides of this issue. And it was wonderful. It was just a great experience.
When you were doing your reporting and meeting people, did people realize that they were talking to the great-great-grandson of Charles Darwin?
Well, they did sooner or later, yes. And I have to say I was treated very well by everybody. And it was a great event. I mean, it was a trial, but it was also a philosophical discourse on the nature of life and existence. And
what is the connection? Who was your great grandparent?
Well, my great great grandfather was Charles Darwin himself. My great grandfather was Sir Francis Darwin, who was a pretty good scientist himself and did a lot of work with his father and with his father's work when he died. My grandmother was called Frances Darwin, and she was a poet. And then my mother was called Claire Cornford, then Chapman, when she married my father.
So Charles didn't meet that grandchild then, because he had died.
He knew my grandmother.
Oh, he did. Okay.
Yeah. And but he didn't meet. He didn't meet me, that's for sure.
Well,
sometimes people ask me, well, did you know your child?
No,
I may look old, but I'm not that old, thank you.
Well, what is it like being the great-great-grandson of Charles Darwin?
Well, it never really meant a thing to me when I lived in England, because in England, as in most of the rest of Europe, evolution is kind of a dead issue. It was really, you know, it really hasn't been a matter of contention since 1900, you know, before that. And so it wasn't really until I came to America and I saw there was considerable objection to his ideas that it became interesting. And then I suddenly thought, well, you know, what does this mean, being a descendant of Darwin? Of course, it doesn't really mean much at all. It's just a sort of an accident of birth, like the royal family. But it did sort of take my interest, and so I got more involved in watching what was going on and listening to what Americans had to say about this. And it's a very revealing, you know, when you start looking at the way people feel about evolution, it's very revealing as to the American character. I think it tells you a lot about Americans.
Well, were you surprised at the extent of hostility to evolution?
I was surprised when I I was surprised. I was very surprised. When I came here first, I've sort of been living here really since the early 1980s. And there were sort of little cases going on even then. And it seemed odd to me, as indeed astrology, you know, the interest in astrology seemed odd to me and still seems odd to me. But then I went down, you know, then I got interested in doing this book about the Scopes trial, and I went down there, and I met a lot of interesting people. And, for example, on the hill outside Dayton, Tennessee, where the famous Scopes monkey trial took place, is a college called the William Jennings Bryan College.
We know all about them.
Yeah, and I got to know a lot of the students up there, and I actually got to like a lot of them a great deal. And, you know, and I was very surprised by some of the attitudes that continued down there. But I was most surprised, really, when I came to meet some of the real hardcore creationists down in Pennsylvania. That was where I saw a new kind of animosity, or it seemed new to me, where people were making connections between Darwin and the devil, and Darwin and Stalin, and Darwin and and every single... I mean, I met one or two people. Most people didn't have this kind of vehemence on it, but I met one or two people who, I would say, hated Satan first and hated Darwin second.
And he was such a nice man.
They really felt strongly about it. I mean, they feel he's responsible for every social ill that exists in modern society. And I don't know if they felt that way 15 years ago or whether this is a new thing. But it was slightly disturbing to see that aspect of it.
Well, I think you're right. Those fires are being fanned even more strongly. We have to take a break here. Okay, we'll be back, right back. I'm Dan Barker. I'm here with Annie Laurie Gaylor for Free Thought Radio, and we're talking with Matthew Chapman, author of the book 40 Days and 40 Nights. We'll be right back.
Hi, my name is Sue from Cross Plains, Wisconsin, and I'm on Free Thought Radio.
Or if you have a problem with organized religion, there is a new radio show just for you. Free Thought Radio.
It ain't necessarily so. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Lou Gaylor with Dan Barker for Free Thought Radio, and we have on the line with us from New York City, in honor of the upcoming birth date anniversary of Charles Darwin, the great-great-grandson of Charles Darwin, Matthew Chapman, the author of 40 Days and 40 Nights. It's covering the so-called intelligent design trial in Dover, Pennsylvania, about to come out in paperback.
The book is called 40 Days and 40 Nights. The subtitle is Darwin, Intelligent Design, God, OxyContin, and Other Oddities on Trial in Pennsylvania. The paperback's coming in March. Is that right, Matthew?
Yes, it is.
And why is OxyContin in the subtitle of your book?
Well, it was one of the school board members who was very eager to have creationism taught in science class, which later became intelligent design, was an ex-cop, ex-prison officer, who had injured his back and had become addicted to OxyContin, which made him particularly sort of unhappy, I suppose you might say, and I think more insensitive than he would have been had he not been addicted to OxyContin. And the reason why I put it in the title was that I thought it was impossible to tell this story without getting some idea of what it was that was motivating people to be so agitated about evolution.
So religion and drugs.
Well, that you see that this kind of irrational reaction to evolution is often, in my opinion, founded on a kind of unhappiness with society and with your position in society. It really has nothing to do with the arguments for or against a scientific theory. And that you couldn't really look at this whole subject without understanding some of that. And, I mean, my feelings towards these people is generally fairly sympathetic. I think they're mistaken, obviously. But if you actually look at them as human beings and show some imagination in trying to understand who they are, it sometimes helps you to be able to understand where they're coming from and what motivates them.
Now, Charles Darwin called himself an agnostic. What do you call yourself?
I'm sort of beginning to think of myself as being a post-atheist, by which I mean that I don't happen to believe in God, but I really want to sort of move on from thinking so much about that as to thinking about the consequences of being an atheist and how one can useful things that kind of bring people together, acting rationally, thinking humanely, being concerned for other people, all without any sort of religious motivation. But when I look at myself and certain Christians who I've become friendly with and who I actually admire a great deal, I see often that we agree about 98% of the things that ought to be done in the world to make it a better place.
So let's work together then.
My friend might not believe in God. My friend might believe in God and that I don't. Is not really the source of the most interesting argument from my point of view at the moment.
Now, you were talking during the break about Science Debate 08. What is that?
Well, that is an initiative that I and a few friends put together. Among them, I might add, some evangelicals, which is we're really concerned that that the issues that we consider to be the most important issues in the world, which are the environment, health and medicine, and technology policy, including science education and stimulating the economy through investment in innovative technology, that these matters are not being discussed in any of the debates at all. All of the candidates are quite happy to sort of pay lip service to these things, but they actually don't seem to want to debate them.
So you're trying to inject some science into the debates?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that what we're saying really is that science is something that encompasses, it can't be discussed in the context of domestic policy or foreign policy. It's so all-encompassing. It touches so many areas of human life that it has to be discussed on its own. It deserves its own debate so that one can discuss the election of the President of America with the thought that everything that he or she does will affect everyone in the world. And you know that the environment, you know, you can't take America and sort of pull it out of the world and look at it as a sort of self-contained organism, because everything is now connected. And so if you even look at something like from a scientific perspective, if you even look at something that appears to be a domestic issue, like healthcare, in fact, healthcare is something that will have to deal with global pandemics, Asian flu, etc., avian flu, and so on and so forth. And that this is something we deserve a debate that discusses these issues from a scientific perspective.
Well, amen. If I can borrow a religious word, amen. We're talking on the phone with Matthew Chapman. He's the author of the book 40 Days and 40 Nights about the intelligent design trial in Dover, Pennsylvania.
How can people find your book, Matthew?
Well, in March, they can go to Barnes & Noble, et cetera, and get it. And it's on Amazon.com. It's at, it is available.
Well, good luck with the science debate, injecting that into the presidential race. And thank you so much for joining Free Thought today.
Thank you very much.
Brian Tarani is our producer, producing and engineering our show. And our announcer is Buzz Kemper. Past shows can be listened to by archive or on a podcast at ffrf.org/radio. Our talkback number is 608-204-0422. 608-204-0422.
Ask for more information about the Freedom From Religion Foundation, a complimentary issue of our newspaper Free Thought Today, at ffrf.org. We thank our guest Matthew Chapman for joining us on Free Thought Radio. Remember, good works, not long prayers.